The Cannabis Conversation. A European perspective on the emerging legal cannabis industry.
Welcome to the Cannabis Conversation with Anusha Sai, where we explore the new legal cannabis industry by speaking to the professionals that are helping to shape it. Hope you're all well. You'll be glad to hear that I recovered from man flu. Was touch and go there for a bit. So, as I mentioned, I wanted to give my reflections on Cannabis Europa. Firstly, it was great to chair a panel on the first day called The Emperor's New Clothes. It was all about hype versus reality in the cannabis industry. It was really great to have Carola Perez on the panel, who had just received news a few days earlier that Spain will legalize medical cannabis. She's been fighting tirelessly for this for years, so huge congrats to her and her fellow patients in Spain. You can check out the panel on YouTube, I think. I'll try and find a link to share. It was also a great honor to host day two of the conference. Day one was hosted by the brilliant Ilana Goldberg from The Kenigma, who's been a previous guest. I took over the reins on day two. I want to say a big thanks to Matt Fremantle from Prohibition Partners. Super lovely guy. Really helpful. Always smiling all day under a lot of pressure. Day one was really fun, but quite overwhelming for me, I think. Saw lots of people I hadn't seen for ages and also got to meet lots of new people who I'd interviewed on the show, but only ever met over Zoom. So it was great to connect in person, but I was completely exhausted by the end of it. So it was actually quite nice to be near the stage on day two and not have to talk to so many people and basically just get to listen to the talks, which was a novelty. What was clear to me was that the European industry is quite confused. There was certainly a lot of talk about Germany and recreational, of course, some quite bullish predictions on what might happen there. I have to say I'm a bit more skeptical on how quickly this might happen, but also how quickly things will ramp up. These things always take longer than we want, and we still have no idea what the regulatory model will actually look like. And I think it's really incumbent on Germany to really get this right. Otherwise, we're serving up easy ammunition for the prohibitionists. And then, of course, Germany still have to figure out their international treaty obligations, both at the UN and EU level. There were quite a few US investors over too, no doubt enticed by the German news, but some also quite realistic. There was one guy from a US fund who was quite on point. He said that if it's part of a business plan to rely on regulatory change, that's not a great thing, and that therefore valuations need to take into account the timing and risk factors. But generally speaking, there are a lot of companies claiming to be medical and talking about being patient first, but not actually talking to any patients or doing any research. I think if you're not doing either of those things, then you're basically a recreational company playing medical until the law changes, which of course is uncertain. I'd like to see more companies being genuinely medical and trying to gather data or evidence to demonstrate efficacy for the products they are producing. Otherwise, I simply have no idea how they're differentiating in this market. Cannabis flower is an unlicensed medicine, and so there are restrictions on what you can say about it. And simply saying that you grow high quality is really not enough. I don't think I've ever met a producer who doesn't say that. And again, even if you genuinely believe that, I'm not sure how you communicate that as an unlicensed medicine. Finally, I think the disconnect between the hype and the money and the patients was really stark. There were quite a few patient groups there who are working voluntary to sort of promote the cause, but are not really very well supported at all financially. And they do get asked by certain companies to give them lots of information, but I don't think there's much coming back to them from these companies. So it would be great if that could be fixed soon. Anyway, now back to the show. We are back again with a show sponsored by our good friends at Lumino. It's about cannabis venture capital. Lumino work with lots of VCs to help staff up their portfolio companies and protect their investments. But VCs also look to Lumino for general market knowledge, as they're so well connected and networked in this space. They're great allies to help find early stage companies and also to understand what's happening in the market. So as always, if you need help with HR recruitment, please do get in touch with them at luminorecruit.com. And obviously, please do mention my name when you do. Now, on with the show. Enjoy. On today's show, I have Hélène Servillon, who is the founding partner of Journey One Ventures. Journey One is a 100% women and minority-owned early-stage VC cannabis fund. Hélène, how are you?
I'm doing good. Happy Tuesday. Here we are.
Yeah, happy Tuesday indeed. We're enjoying some sunshine. Are you in California? You enjoy a lot of sunshine, I bet.
I born and raised in San Francisco, but living in Boulder, Colorado, which is apparently one of the sunniest places to live in the U.S.
Well, there you go. You're definitely spoiled by that. We aren't here, so it's nice when it's out. But we could talk about the weather forever, couldn't we? How are you? How are you getting on generally in the midway through 2022?
It's good. I mean, we're approaching summer here, so the landscape definitely shifts in terms of people going on vacation, and Q2 and the cannabis industry has been nuts, just with all of the pushback from conferences that were rescheduled due to the COVID outbreaks during winter. And so it's been a very, very busy last couple months, and excited to work on some operational things in the back end at the fund.
Yeah. And how long have you been in Colorado for? How is it being there?
Yeah, I moved to October 2020 and was living in Los Angeles for 6.5 years. And so everybody always says, oh, you moved to Colorado for the cannabis industry. It's so funny because Los Angeles is the biggest global consumer market. And, you know, Colorado was the first to really kick off adult use in the States. And there's a really awesome, I don't know if I call it legacy market in Colorado, but yes, a little bit of that. But just historical, like, market, a lot of people who've been in the industry for, you know, decade and a half. When I tell people I've been in cannabis for 5 years and I meet someone who's been in it 10 years, I'm like, wow, you have a crazy amount of experience. And so it's a really awesome community. And just in Boulder itself, there's about 70 executives in the cannabis industry, and there's 100,000 people in this city. And that doesn't even include Denver. So it's a great community. And Patrick Rea from Poseidon hosted an executive event 2 Tuesdays ago. And so people are starting to really get out and just socialize again. And it's nice to, you know, be a part of the community.
Yeah, great, great. And we'll hear a bit more about what you're up to in a second. We usually start with the kind of traditional place of talking a bit about yourself and your background and how and why you came to be in the cannabis space. So over to you.
Well, my background is very atypical for a venture fund manager and now investment banker in the cannabis industry. I'll talk about the banking side, which was newly announced in March. But I was born and bred an early stage operator, primarily working in emerging industries. So when cannabis came into my ether, I got really excited about it. But historically have worked in emerging industries such as the light electric vehicle, electric bike space. I was in voice analytics and working at early stage startups, and then started my career off at Puma Reebok Corporate. And so when you're working at early stage startups, you often run into venture capitalists. And at this point in time in my career, I was really enjoying working in enterprise tech. I had my own office in Los Angeles. My company was based out of San Francisco, and we were venture backed, had a really smart team, and, you know, ran customer success, and then started working on channel partner strategies for the telecom space. And wanted to not be a cog in the wheel in my career. I wanted to really understand how capital worked and how that could shift and shape businesses and cultures. So upon that quest, the Me Too movement really took off, and the number of capital going to female founders was astounding. It was like 2.1%. Much hasn't changed in terms of the total dollars that have gone to venture. More dollars have gone to venture, but in terms of the percentage that go to women founders, it's still around that 2%, which is unfortunate. But we have to take wins where we can get them. And so I decided that I wanted to be a venture capitalist, and that my focal point would be in the cannabis industry. And this was right before cannabis was becoming adult use legal in California in 2018. So there was a ton of hype and excitement around it. And I would go to events in Los Angeles after work hours when I was still working in tech, just to explore, and really, really loved the culture. So I think, you know, opportunity brought me in, the people in the plant kept me in. And how I see the landscape for cannabis is that we're really just starting to get, we're just heating up here. And it's the nice thing, it's not a US market, it's a global market, but much of the concentration right now is in the North American market.
Yeah, very much so, very much so. And we'll get onto that in a second. Did you have any personal issues or encounter any stigma when you decided to get into cannabis, or did you have any hesitancy when you were looking at it as an area?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because, well, I grew up in San Francisco, and my brother got in trouble for having, you know, weed in his car at one point by my mom. But where I went to high school, I went to Lowell, which is one of the oldest public schools west of the Mississippi, and very alternative in terms of how you grow up in San Francisco, the people that you're surrounded with. So very open environment. And some of the quote unquote stoners in my high school were like the smartest kids at my school. So I didn't have that much stigma growing up with it to unlearn. I played D1 volleyball at Northeastern in Boston, and we were randomly drug test. So that sucked. I would typically consume cannabis right after a drug test because I knew that I wouldn't get tested again for like another 90 days. And so I'd always, you know, recreationally used cannabis, whether it's, you know, wellness, it was always something fun that I wanted to just like relax with. And so my experience with the plant has always primarily been, you know, as a consumer on both like the, let's call it recreational and wellness side.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. Well, let's get a bit more into the VC side of things that you were talking about, but also just a bit about what you're doing. So we'll talk about Journey One, but also you can talk about your new career in investment banking as well.
Let's do it. Yeah. So at Journey One Ventures, we are early stage focused fund on primarily within pre-seed to Series A investments in the cannabis sector. And I'm focused on what I identify as the venture scale categories of the market, which include tech-enabled services, as well as companies with unique IP. So looking for really scalable business models, if it is, you know, consumer-facing product or consumer tech, something that has like a moat around it. So we have 5 flagship deals in the fund across reg tech, tech-enabled distribution. We do have beverage, as well as a CPG company in the firm as well, and biotech. And, you know, we can invest across the market, but really focused on themes within the cannabis sector and where are the biggest problems in the market. So medicinal grade cannabis is one of them. It's still early stages within medical applications, given the federal restrictions and clinical trials, and in order to claim that cannabis can heal for certain types of ailments. But when you look at, you know, the pharma, biopharma side of cannabis, those are huge potential exit multiples and mainly binary deals, right? You're either writing it off as a huge potential exit, or if it doesn't do well and takes a lot of capital, maybe it's a zero. So I would say we have roughly anywhere from 15 to 20% of our capital allocated to that sector. And then the second one is e-commerce. So, you know, cannabis is primarily, all the sales are primarily driven through retail and delivery in the US market. I would say anywhere upwards of like 90% retail, depending upon the market, 10% delivery. But most of all of those sales transactions are going through point of sale systems, and we don't have scale within direct to consumer platforms yet, where brands can develop relationships directly with their consumers and kind of understand their buying behaviors, the things that they like, in order to forecast what is the best product that they want to buy and when. And so we are starting to see some of those early platforms in the California market. Most notable ones, I would say, is Ginger and Grassdoor, and Amuse has also finagled with direct-to-consumer platforms. But when you look at e-commerce and cannabis, it creates a whole entire ecosystem, because we can't use, you know, digital advertising platforms like Google, Facebook, Instagram. There is marketing compliance that is important within the cannabis industry, given that you can't market to children and you can't make, you know, health claims, for example, around cannabis products. So when you look at outside the cannabis industry and how consumers are buying, it's omnichannel. And right now we have two channels. And so we will get to that point within cannabis consumption where there's more optionality. But given the regulatory compliance with cannabis, where, you know, your couriers also have to be licensed, we just can't replicate the same model that Shopify has replicated with FedEx and USPS. We have to have, you know, cannabis licensed operators distribute the goods. And so that's a category that I see really heating up in next 3 to 5 years. And then the other category is core services. And how I define core services is any tech or tech-enabled company that is specifically nuanced for serving the cannabis industry. So that includes fintech services, banks. It also includes like regulatory compliance platforms, as well as ERP and, you know, POS systems. So those are the three core themes that I see. And our thesis is always driven by, you know, what are the biggest pain points in the market? When I think about where the cannabis industry is today, we are still heavily focused on infrastructure, right? So we still have new markets like the tri-state markets, Connecticut, New Jersey, New York. Right now, they're focused on licensing distribution. And the more mature markets like California, Pacific Northwest, Nevada, Colorado, you know, we're focused on tech infrastructure and servicing some of those companies who are looking to scale from early stage to growth to even to IPO and exit. And so those companies have fundamentally different needs than some of the nascent markets. So it makes it really interesting to follow cannabis because you're looking at like 39 different states, but they almost act as 39 different countries in the same country.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there's loads of stuff that we're going to go into when we talk a bit about the wider investment thesis, but it's good that you sort of identify three buckets that you kind of look at and the approach that you're taking. And I'm going to ask you a few more questions about Journey One in a second, but you've also got another role as well, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Like everybody in cannabis has how many different hats? But recently I joined Bowen, which is a growth tech investment bank at Boston, Massachusetts. We've been around for 20 years and I am a senior advisor and help lead the cannabis practice. So we have 7 total practices in addition to cannabis. The primary ones that are most tangential to cannabis is life science, healthcare, consumer tech, as well as sustainable food and agriculture. So I was really excited when this opportunity came about because Paul Bowen is an LP in my fund and he's the founding partner of Bowen. And so there's strategic alignment there because there was no way I was going to give up what I was building at Journey One. But what this gives me the ability to do is really see pre-seed to companies at exit within the cannabis market. So I focus on Series B through D capital raise advisory and then buy side, sell side M&A for both plant touching companies and ancillary. But now there's, you know, there's a reason for me to really engage with the, you know, tier 1 to tier 3 MSOs and the tech companies in the market like Springbrig and Leafly who have IPO to better understand where they're at today, what their growth trajectory looks like and how that includes their M&A strategy. So there's a ton of M&A happening in the market and that gives me the ability to be better informed with how I make decisions on the early stage side. And then on the early stage side, it provides a pipeline of opportunities for potential clients on the Bowen side. So really fun work, very, very strategic. My brain is stretched in many different ways throughout the day. And just really fortunate to be working with such strong teams on both sides. I didn't talk about our advisor team at Journey One, but I'm really proud to say that we have so much diversity when it comes to the service providers that we work with, the advisors that are on board. So Paige Checkey and Heather Malloy, they were on the M&A team at TerrAscend and worked on, you know, around $350 million of M&A transaction and are really growth stage investors. So they're on my investment advisory team. And then Anna Rae Grabstein, she was the former CEO of Steep Hill Labs, which is one of the first testing labs in the US market that launched in the Bay Area. And then she later worked at NorCal Cannabis as a COO. And so she's a operations whiz, a compliance whiz. NorCal Cannabis is a vertically integrated cannabis company out of Northern California, Bay Area. And they used to, you know, run the depots for ease back in the day, but now they've, you know, are more focused on their core business. So when I look at the folks on board and, you know, how we build our thesis, it's like, let's get operators who really have been in the trenches and seen evolutions of the cannabis industry. So as, you know, I focus on the early stage side, bring on growth folks who might have contrarian thoughts about the industry, and we can battle it out during our, you know, investment memo conversations. And now I also have the resources of the Bowen team to help me look at what's not only happening in the cannabis industry, but those tangential markets that hit the cannabis industry, like healthcare, general tech, because, you know, we've seen both DoorDash, Uber, Amazon make strides in the cannabis industry, as well as Boston Beer Works, who recently launched a tea beverage, and PBR, Pabst Blue Ribbon, who also launched a beverage. So there's the way that I think about how to position what I do in the industry and my network is being an expert within cannabis, but also being a bridge to the outside world. And when it's time to come in, most of them will come in during federal legalization or when we have foresight into that, but they'll have a question of, do I buy or build? And I would love to, you know, I'm positioning myself to be in those conversations for both buying and building.
Yeah, no, and I think you're doing a really good job. It's you're managing to sort of see the whole life cycle, and that would be essential to all of those roles, I think, in being that sort of central connector. So yeah, well done. Kudos and good luck. Sounds like you're going to be a busy young woman, which is great. And look, we're going to get onto the sort of the main topic of the show in a second, but, you know, Journey One, it would be remiss to not kind of ask a bit about the female and minority owned aspects of it, because, you know, I speak to a lot of VCs on this side of the pond and on your side of the pond too. And, you know, maybe there are a couple of brown faces. There are very few female faces and no black faces either. So yeah, that, how much of a challenge has that all been?
So I don't think it's been a challenge per se. Let's rewind a little bit in terms of why I decided to start this journey. So when I first got into cannabis, I worked for two family offices and then, you know, got a handful of experience. They didn't have full exposure into the cannabis industry. They wanted to do a few deals here and there. So some of those companies that I came across during my time at the family offices, we invested in Meadow Confident Cannabis, which is Y Combinator's first portfolio of cannabis deals that they brought into the accelerator. And then when I was at the other family office called Studio Management, we invested in Jane Technology Series B. And so my trajectory would have been, you know, leave those family offices and work for other firms in the industry. And I just didn't have that investment banking background or typical finance background. I was more of an early stage operator that could get my hands dirty and really know how to help these companies scale. And so because I didn't have a background, the opportunity for me was pretty slim. And I ended up going to a VC trade school in January 2019 for a quarter to understand processes of, you know, running an investment process from start to finish. And so I did my first self-led syndicate investment at that point in time into a company called Flower Company, which is a membership delivery club service out of California that offers wholesale price cannabis to undercut the illicit market retail prices. And, you know, sourced all my investors, wrote the entire memo, sourced the company, and realized that, wow, this is super fun to do. And so the mentors within that program, they had managed over, you know, $1.5 billion assets and across the funds and invested in companies like Venmo and Limebike and Business Insider and BuzzFeed. It encouraged me to run a fund. And I was like, you guys are crazy. Like, What do you mean, like me run a fund? That's a funny joke. And throughout that process, it was a 2-year process for me to really believe that it was possible. And that belief came with just by doing deal by deal, leading my own syndicate and building my own Rolodex. So I truly built my investor base from the ground up. And I had a Twitter chat with someone online, and they're like, you know, if you don't know how to raise money from friends and family, you're not a good investor, something like that. I was like, you know, I didn't have the privilege to raise money from friends and family. I just didn't grow up with that fortune. I put myself through college and all of that. So, you know, going back to your question, it was really important to me that I set a precedent of, you know, building a diverse fund and being one of the few female fund managers in the market. There are more female investors now, but the numbers are still pretty slim. I think relative to the overall category of venture capital, the cannabis industry is still living in ancient days when it comes to diversity. And I got into the industry because I saw how much variety there was within age demographics, gender dynamics, as well as racial backgrounds. And then I got to the mid to senior C-suite level and capital side of the market, and it was really shocking. And so we don't have a mandate for number of founders that come from XYZ backgrounds, you know, and the reason why is that my goal is to prove a point that you don't have to if you put diverse fund manager, an underrepresented fund manager from different backgrounds in the decision-making seat. And so, you know, I think sometimes we're often mistaken for only investing in female founders and only investing in social equity initiatives, which is really interesting because that isn't part of what we do, but it's part of what we support. So I try to be very mindful and, you know, direct with people on what we do. And it's focused on venture scale companies in cannabis and finding the most kick-ass founders possible. We, out of the 5 flagship deals, 2 of our co-founders are females. And so, you know, we're looking to have 25 to 30 portfolio companies and are still looking to grow those diversity initiatives, but it is not what drives our thesis.
Yeah, I think that's really a great way to approach this. And yeah, just hopefully by the diversity of your makeup, you'll notice other good deals, but ultimately they have to be good deals. It doesn't matter who's running them. So that's great to hear. So let's move on to kind of, you know, there's loads more I could have asked you on that, but I'm conscious of getting onto the main topic, which was just around sort of building a cannabis investment thesis, you know, from your perspective. And cannabis is very big and wide, and you've already talked about a number of subsectors. So where do you start?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because when people think of cannabis, they isolate it within its own category, but it is an industry that encompasses all different facets of business, from consumer packaged goods as like the core. So when I think about what is the cannabis industry, it is a regulated CPG industry. It's a high value crop that has applications for medicinal, wellness, and recreational. It's unlike alcohol, unlike tobacco, in that the medicinal use case has a whole nother category of opportunities when it comes to applications for sleep, pain, anxiety, neurology, and oncology. But we still haven't really addressed what that is yet from a medical standpoint, given where we're at with research on the plant and people. So there's that. But there's also, you know, B2B SaaS within cannabis and enterprise applications and consumer tech. So the world is a lot bigger than what most traditional investors think about. And so when I pitch, you know, the opportunities in cannabis to traditional VCs, like, you know, Sequoia Capital, First Round Capital, they say, well, you know, cannabis is just cannabis. It's a big market. And I start off with saying, well, it's a double-digit billion-dollar market today, roughly around 25 to 27 billion in 2021 in just the US market alone. It's growing at a 40% CAGR and is on target to do 2x that by 2025. But the reason why we need all of these unique software applications and unique services is because of the regulatory restrictions and also the market fragmentation. So we can't use traditional payment processing like Amex, Discovery, MasterCard, Visa. We can't use FedEx, USPS. We can't use traditional advertising. We can't use traditional banks. So everything that is required for any other industry to operate, we just don't have that. So we need to create these unique software platforms to enable the industry to even operate. So when looking at, okay, well, all right, the picture's big. Where do we start? I always say, start where your background is, right? Where you came from and kind of work your way into different sectors of the market. So I came from a tech background right before I got into the cannabis industry, B2B enterprise tech, but also have exposure to consumer side. And when I worked at the family offices, a lot of the exposure I had were within cannabis tech companies. So I mentioned Jane, I mentioned Meta, which is a POS company. I mentioned Confident Cannabis, which does B2B wholesale, as well as a LIMS, like a, you know, lab information management platform to test cannabis goods. And that's where I've started. In terms of where I'm exploring right now, is I look at, okay, well, where is the market today? What are some of the catalysts that fuel growth? So some themes that I'm seeing is the financial sector of the market ahead of Safe Banking Act. So if you look at the last couple quarters within cannabis, roughly around 90% of new capital in was actually debt financing. Most of that was licensed operators and MSOs in the US market that were, you know, financing to do land grabs within new territories to buy licenses, build out their manufacturing, cultivation facilities, retail, what have you. And so that's one of them. And then within the financing landscape and financial services is the restrictions that early stage cannabis companies have when it comes to getting access to capital. So most capital is primarily equity. Depending upon the type of company you're building, you might not have access to lending options because if you don't have any assets, you'd have nothing to lend against, or they'll just take your IP, which if you're an early stage startup may not be, you know, have any value until you get to like $5 to $10 million in revenue. So companies I'm looking at right now in that sector, you know, are tech enabled lending platforms. It's also the banking side, payment processing, and also financial compliance companies. So one of our companies, Complied, is an API platform that enables operators and financial institutions to essentially track their transactions. So when you think about when Safe Banking Act happens, which enables, you know, federal institutions to not get in trouble for servicing state legal cannabis companies, they'll do KYC AML and they can verify that that client, you know, has a license and is legally operating. But how do they verify that the transactions that that client is processing are legal? That's another big caveat, right? So one of our portfolio companies, Complied, is working towards that. So that's how I see opportunity within the financial sector. It's really looking at, okay, well, what are the different pieces to the puzzle of this ecosystem? And what is the timeline? Because I think timing is really important when it comes to investing, right? Like you could be too early if you're an investor in VR, right? Or someone had a great idea for Uber and Lyft, but we didn't have mobile phones yet. It's like, well, how do we, does it even matter that like, am I going to use like dial-in to get my driver? So I typically look at a spectrum, a roadmap within an ecosystem and a timeline and make guesstimates back with data, of course, and other industry experts, because you have to do a ton of field research, right? So when investors are doing thesis-based investing versus opportunity-based investing, you're preparing your mind for an opportunity and then trying to strike at the right time.
That's loads there, isn't there? But I think it's a great approach to start with an area that you know well and then move out from there as you learn more. How important is it to sort of define what's off limits as well?
I think it's always good as both an investor and a founder to know what you do and what you don't do. You know, I think as when it comes to what we can invest into at Journey One, we can invest into every category in cannabis, but some have proven to not be venture scale. So for example, I'm not focused on licensed operators. Right now, terrible example, but they're trading at like, you know, 1x or at most 2x this year's revenue. And you might as well invest in a licensed operator in the public markets because you have liquidity. So the benefit of, okay, well, why do I invest in Journey One? It's to get access to companies that I couldn't otherwise get access to. But I also don't believe in proprietary deal flow in cannabis because the supply and demand dynamics are for investors' advantage. Like, we're not necessarily like fighting other funds to get into deals or lead deals. It's a very collaborative industry. So I look at what are the best deals to do and when versus, you know, I'm telling my LPs in my fund that we have access to deals before other folks, which is true too, but not the only part of it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think you kind of touched on a slight bit of this, but how does the network aspect come into it, particularly around building a portfolio? So the synergies between the portfolio companies, how important is that? Or do you try and look at things in isolation of this is a good opportunity based on fundamentals or whatever analysis and DD you've done?
I think portfolio synergy is always important, but it is not the deal breaker for us because I think that there's so much variety within cannabis that it shouldn't like hold us back. It should only be additive into opportunities that we see. So for example, let's see. So we're investors in Navis, which is tech-enabled distribution. We're investors in Sleepree, which is essentially the Beyond Meat for developing lab-made cannabis compounds. We're also in Complied, which I mentioned, which is a regulatory API compliance platform. So three fundamentally very different businesses. There's opportunity for Complied to service Navis as a continue to scale multi-state as Complied provides a one-point entry into the trace and track state-mandated systems like BioTrack, Metric, and LeafWorks. And so Navis could, you know, if they want to scale or when they scale out of state, because they're working on that right now, instead of doing a direct integrations with Metric on a state-by-state basis and managing that, they can just plug into Complied. So there's a ton of synergy, but, you know, out of 30 portfolio companies, are 30 of them going to have potential to work together? Hard to create that type of synergy, but the cannabis industry is so intimate, as I mentioned before. And so we tend to lean on the founders that we work with for intros and say, hey, you know, this is what this company does when we do onboarding. Is there any need for an introduction here? How can we help? Is there any way for you to help them? So right now, my focus is, you know, now that we have our initial flagship deals up, how can we create some of those opportunities for and building a community within our portfolio company for them to help each other out?
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. And looking at everything on its own merits is a good approach as well, I think. So as you kind of come towards the end, I think, you know, it's a bit difficult because you're in probably the leading market, aren't you? But do you ever look at other jurisdictions beyond the US? But I mean, I'm looking probably Canada, really, I'm thinking.
Yeah. So we are primarily focused on the North American market. And that decision was really driven on my expertise on the regulations and my network here. I think that there's a ton of opportunity outside the US. For example, you know, Europe, your market, as well as South America is starting to really heat up in Colombia and Mexico, but it is a completely different ballgame. And there's so much opportunity here in North America alone that I try not to get too distracted. But, you know, the end goal is to build for outside of the ecosystem. But I think timing right now is more lucrative here in the States.
Yes, absolutely. I think you've got enough on your plate where you are. So that makes complete sense.
For you, I'm curious, like, you know, we caught up a few months ago in terms of the state of the European market. What are two of the optimistic things that you see about the market, like where you're headed And what are two of the disappointments?
Wow. Well, I think, you know, everyone is very optimistic about Germany. And actually, I think the noises that have been coming out since the original announcement have kind of backed that up. Now, as everyone knows, it takes always takes a bit longer to get policies and processes in place. But, you know, I think, you know, it's the biggest economy in Europe. So that would be a real game changer, because I think it would really kind of, it would set the prime example for everyone else to look to, I think. But I do think it's incumbent on them to not mess it up, because there's going to be a lot of people who are not keen on cannabis. And if they see a system that doesn't work, they'll then use that as a reason to not liberalize either. What has been the biggest disappointment? I think it's just in terms of, it's very medical here, right? So it's the pace of, you know, regulations easing and doctors prescribing cannabis has been not fast enough, really. And so it's growing, but not a very quick rate. And that's been probably the biggest disappointment. Well, particularly as I've been in it for about 4 years now. And yeah, I was hoping I'd be, you know, on a yacht now, retired. But
don't we
all? I'm joking. No.
One day.
No. But I mean, that's actually it's sort of part of it all, right? You know, I think I very quickly realized that I had to have a slightly longer term perspective, and I very much feel that now. But yeah, I think I would have hoped for more progress by now over 4 years. And the UK, where I am in particular, is very backwards when it comes to this. And the politicians on both sides don't really look, you know, it's not very hopeful that they're going to be liberalizing things very soon. I think they'll be more governed and moved by success stories from abroad, but then they're not going to make any kind of first moves, let's say.
Yeah, I mean, how legislation is moved forward progressively in the U.S. is really driven by tax dollars and money. So if they can see the bags like at the US, end of right? the rainbow, yeah, yeah, corporate America, it's great. I guess it's different incentives in different markets, but that's why, you know, we have about 39 medical states in the U.S., 19 adult use states here. And when I think about social, economic, and geographical impact relative to other venture investable markets in the US, I see nothing that compares to the diversity that cannabis impact brings in terms of states like Oklahoma and Ohio, where investors are looking for ways to invest back into those states and also for increase in employment. Cannabis is fundamentally key to some of these not forgotten states, but, you know, the economies within those.
Yeah, they could do with a boost, let's say. Yeah,
exactly. So you have to look at it from that lens and how people make decisions.
Absolutely. Cool. Well, Ellen, thank you so much for joining us today. Super interesting to hear about your projects, and you sound phenomenally busy. So I'm really glad that you spared the time to chat. Yeah, it'd be great to have you back on the show at some point and see how you're getting on.
I know. It's always fun when you get to revisit those conversations. And when I first got started in cannabis, I learned through podcasts. I really did.
Fantastic. That's the perfect sales pitch at the end there. Thank you very much.
Anoush, thank you so much for having me. You're wonderful. You've connected me with some awesome people in Europe, and excited to continue our relationship here.
Brilliant. Thanks, Ellen. Take care.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, please subscribe, rate, review, and share the podcast. It will help me spread the good word on how this amazing industry is developing. I work with various cannabis startups to help them get funded and grow. I also work with corporates and international cannabis companies to help them understand and navigate the European cannabis sector. We're working with some great clients across the cannabis value chain, and we'd love to help you too. Please visit www.canverse.global to get in touch.